You are listening to rudolfsteineraudio.com. This is a reading of a book by Rudolf Steiner, the Bamford translation of How to Know Higher Worlds, A Modern Path of Initiation. This is Chapter 6, entitled Some Effects of Initiation. Paragraph 1. One of the basic principles of true esoteric science is that those who dedicate themselves to it must do so in full consciousness. As students, we should undertake nothing nor engage in any exercises whose effects we do not understand. An esoteric teacher, when giving advice or instruction, will always explain what the effects of following the instruction will be on the body, soul, or spirit of the person striving for higher knowledge. Paragraph 2. The present chapter will describe some of the effects of inner work upon the soul of the esoteric student. Not until we are aware of these effects can we practice the exercises that lead to knowledge of the supersensible worlds in full consciousness. Indeed, only the presence of such full consciousness allows us to be called true students of this path. Authentic spiritual training forbids any groping in the dark. Those who do not wish to carry out their training with open eyes may become mediums, but they will never become seers or clairvoyants, as esoteric science uses these terms. Paragraph 3. Those who practice the exercises described in the previous chapters will first of all experience certain changes in their so-called, quote, soul organism, close quote. Only a seer can perceive this organism, which may be compared to a more or less soul-spiritually luminous cloud, whose center is the physical body. Footnote. A detailed description of this can be found in my book titled Theosophy, An Introduction to the Spiritual Processes at Work in Human Life and in the Cosmos. End of footnote. All our instincts, desires, passions, ideas, and so on are spiritually visible within this cloud. For example, sensual desires are perceived in the form of dark red rays radiating in a certain form, while pure and noble thoughts express themselves in radiating red-purple hues. Sharply defined concepts, such as grasped by a logical thinker, are felt as yellowish forms with quite distinct outlines. But the muddled thoughts of confused minds appear indistinct. Intolerant and opinionated thoughts appear sharp, fixed, and inflexible, while thoughts open to the concerns of others appear flexible and changing, and so on. Footnote. It is important to keep in mind that in all such descriptions, in quotes, seeing, a color refers to spiritual seeing or vision. In terms of clairvoyant cognition, quote, seeing red, close quote, means that we have an experience in the soul spiritual realm that is like the physical experience we have when looking at the color red. Thus, in the case of clairvoyant cognition, it is natural to use the expression seeing red, and that is the only reason why the expression is used. We must keep this in mind to avoid mistaking a color vision for a truly clairvoyant experience. End of footnote. Paragraph 4. The further we advance in soul development, the more regularly structured our soul organism becomes. This organism remains confused and unstructured in a person whose soul life is still undeveloped. Yet, even in such an unstructured soul organism, a clairvoyant can still see a form that stands out clearly from its surroundings. The form extends from the inside of the head to the middle of the physical body. To the clairvoyant, it looks like an independent body containing certain organs. These organs, which we shall now consider, may be seen spiritually in the following areas of the physical body. The first, between the eyes. The second, near the larynx. The third, in the region of the heart. The fourth, in the neighborhood of the pit of the stomach, or solar plexus. And the fifth and the sixth, in the lower abdomen, or reproductive region. Because they resemble wheels or flowers, esotericists call these formations chakras, wheels, or in quotes, lotus flowers. But these expressions are no more accurate than calling the parts of a building wings. In both cases, we are dealing only with figures of speech, with analogies. In a person whose soul life is undeveloped, the lotus flowers are of a darkish color, quiet and unmoving. In a seer, on the other hand, they are in motion, shining forth in different colors. With some differences, the same occurs in the case of mediums, but this does not concern us here. One of the first things to occur when an esoteric student begins practicing the exercises is that the light of the lotus flowers intensifies. Later, the flowers will also begin to rotate. When this happens, it means that a person is beginning to have the ability to see clairvoyantly. Footnote: what was explained in the preceding note regarding the perception of colors applies also to these perceptions of rotation, and indeed of the lotus flowers themselves. End of footnote. These flowers are the sense organs of the soul. Their rotation indicates that we are able to perceive the supersensible realm. Until we have developed the astral senses in this way, we cannot see anything supersensible. Paragraph 5. The spiritual sense organ, which is situated near the larynx, enables us to see clairvoyantly into the way of thinking of other soul beings. It also allows us a deeper insight into the true laws of natural phenomena. While the organ located in the region of the heart opens clairvoyant cognition into the mentality and character of other souls. Whoever has developed this organ is also able to cognize certain deeper forces in plants and animals. With the sense organ situated near the solar plexus, we gain insight into the abilities and talents of other souls and see what role animals, plants, minerals, metals, atmospheric phenomena, and so on, play in the household of nature. Paragraph 6. The organ in the vicinity of the larynx has 16 petals or spokes, the one near the heart, 12, and the one near the solar plexus, 10. Paragraph 7. Specific soul activities are connected with the development of these sense organs. Whoever practices these activities in a particular way contributes to the development of the corresponding spiritual sense organ. For example, 8 of the 16 petals of the 16-petaled lotus flower, near the larynx, were formed in the distant past, in an earlier evolutionary stage. We ourselves contributed nothing to their development. We received these first 8 petals as a gift of nature, at a time when human consciousness was still dreamlike and dull. These 8 petals were already active then, and their activities corresponded to this state of dim consciousness. As consciousness intensified, these lotus petals then lost their light and ceased their activity, We ourselves can form the remaining 8 petals through the conscious practice of exercises. This will make the whole lotus flower shining and mobile. The acquisition of specific faculties depends upon the development of each of these 16 lotus petals. As already implied, however, we can develop only 8 of these petals consciously. The other 8 then appear of their own accord. Paragraph 8. To develop the 16-petaled lotus flower, we proceed as follows. We direct our care and attention to 8 specific soul processes that we usually perform without care or attention. The first soul process concerns the way in which we acquire ideas or mental images. As a rule, we leave this to chance. We happen to see or hear something, and then we form our concepts on that basis. As long as we behave in this way, the 16-petaled lotus flower remains quite inactive. But when we begin to discipline ourselves, it begins to move. Discipline here means that we pay attention to our ideas or mental representations. Each one must become meaningful to us. We must begin to see in every image or idea a specific message about something in the outer world. Ideas that do not have a meaning for the outer world should no longer satisfy us. We must guide our conceptual life to become a true mirror of the outer world. All our striving must be to eliminate false ideas from the soul. The second soul process to be considered, much in the same way as the first, is how we make decisions. Any decision, even the most trivial, should be made only after thorough, well-reasoned deliberation. We should remove all thoughtless activity and meaningless action from our souls. We must have well-thought-out reasons for all we do. Anything we cannot find a reason for, we must refrain from doing. The third soul process concerns speech. When we are esoteric students, every word should have substance and meaning. Talk for talking's sake diverts us from the path. We must avoid the ordinary kind of conversation where everyone talks at the same time and topics are indiscriminately jumbled together. This does not mean that we should cut ourselves off from interaction with our fellow human beings. On the contrary, it is precisely in interaction with others that we should learn to make our words meaningful. We should be ready to speak to and answer everyone, but only after having taken thought and thoroughly considered the issue at hand. We should never speak without good reason. We should talk neither too much nor too little. The fourth soul process concerns the ordering of our outer actions. As esoteric students, we should try to manage our affairs so that they fit both with the affairs of others and with events around us. We should abstain from any behavior that would disturb others or otherwise go against what is happening around us. We should strive to direct our activity so that it integrates harmoniously into our surroundings, our situation in life, and so forth. When a situation prompts us to act, we should consider carefully how best to respond to this prompting. And when we act on our own initiative, we should weigh the consequences of what we intend to do as clearly as we can. At this point, the fifth soul process comes under consideration, namely the arrangement and organization of our life as a whole. As esoteric students, we must strive to live in harmony with both nature and spirit. We must be neither over hasty nor slow and lazy. Hyperactivity and laxity should be equally alien to us. We should see life itself as a way of working and arrange it accordingly. We should take care of our health and regulate our habits, so that a harmonious life ensues as a consequence. The sixth soul process has to do with human striving or effort. As esoteric students, we must assess our talents and abilities, and then act in accordance with this self-knowledge. We should not try to do anything that lies beyond our powers. Yet, we must always do everything that lies within our powers to do. At the same time, we must set ourselves aspirations connected to humanity's great ideals and obligations. We should not thoughtlessly place ourselves as mere cogs in the vast human machine, but try to understand our tasks and learn to look beyond our daily routines. Hence, we should always strive to perfect the performance of our duties. The seventh soul process involves the effort to learn as much as possible from life. As esoteric students, nothing comes to us in life that does not provide an opportunity to gather experiences useful for the future. Mistakes and imperfections become an incentive to perform more correctly and perfectly whenever a similar situation next arises. In the same way, we can learn from watching others. We should try to gather as rich a treasure of experience as possible, conscientiously drawing on it for advice at all times. We should do nothing without looking back upon the experiences that can help us to decide and act. Finally, the eighth soul process. As esoteric students, we should periodically turn and look inward. We must sink, absorbed into ourselves, gently taking counsel with ourselves, shaping and testing our basic principles of life, mentally reviewing what we know, weighing our obligations, pondering the meaning and purpose of life, and so forth. All this has been discussed in earlier chapters and is summarized here only for its connection with the 16-petaled lotus flower. The practice of these activities perfects our lotus flower, for the development of clairvoyance depends on such exercises. For example, the more our thoughts and words harmonize with events in the outer world, the more quickly we develop this gift. In contrast, when we think or say something untrue, we destroy something in the bud of the 16-petaled lotus flower. In this regard, truthfulness, sincerity, and honesty are constructive forces, while lying, falsity, and insincerity are destructive ones. On the esoteric path, we must be aware that what matters is not, in quotes, good intentions, but what we actually do. If I think or say something that does not correspond to reality, I destroy something in my spiritual sense organ, regardless of how good I think my intentions are. Similarly, a child gets burnt when it puts its hands into the fire, even though it acts out of ignorance. In sum, if we orient these soul processes in the ways outlined here, the 16-petaled lotus flower will shine forth in glorious colors and move in accordance with its inherent laws. It must be noted, however, that the faculty of seeing will appear only after a certain level of soul development has been attained. So long as it is still an effort to orient our life in this direction, the gift of seeing will not reveal itself. We are not ready for it if we still need to pay special attention to the activities described here. When living in this way has become second nature to us, then the first signs of seeing or clairvoyance will appear. At that point, we will no longer need to struggle and spur ourselves on to this new way of life. We will live it naturally and effortlessly. There are certain other and easier methods for developing the 16-petal lotus flower. True spiritual science rejects such methods because they lead to the destruction of our physical health and to moral corruption. The instructions presented here may require more time and effort, but they will lead us safely to our goal and can only strengthen our moral life. Paragraph 9. Certain forms of clairvoyance seeing appear as the result of distortions in the development of lotus flowers. In this case, the seeing is marked not only by illusions and fantastic ideas, but also by deviance and instability in daily life. As a result of such warped development, a person may become fearful, jealous, conceited, arrogant, willful, and so on, even though he or she did not have these traits before. As stated above, 8 of the 16 petals of the lotus flower were developed in the far distant past and reappear of their own accord during esoteric schooling. The care and attention of the student, therefore, must be directed toward developing the 8 new petals. In false approaches to esoteric schooling, the already developed earlier petals can easily appear alone, while the new petals, still needing to be formed, remain stunted. This happens particularly when not enough attention is paid to logical, level-headed thinking in the training. Of prime importance is that the student of esotericism be a sensible person, devoted to clear thinking. Equally important is to strive for the greatest clarity in speech. When we begin to have a first inkling of the supersensible, we are tempted to talk about it, but this only impedes our development. Until we have gained a certain degree of clarity in these matters, the less we say about them, the better. At the beginning of our training, we may be surprised to find how little curiosity spiritually schooled persons show for our experiences. Indeed, it would be healthiest for us if we said nothing at all about our experiences, and instead spoke only about how well or how badly we managed to carry out the exercises or follow our instructions. Those who are schooled spiritually have sources other than a student's own direct account for evaluating his or her progress. Besides, talking about our experiences always somewhat hardens the 8 petals we are developing, and these should remain soft and pliable. An example taken for the sake of clarity from ordinary rather than supersensible life will illustrate this point. Suppose I receive news about something and immediately form a judgment about it. Shortly thereafter, I learn more, but the new information does not agree with the first news I received. Hence I am obliged to revise my opinion. The consequence of this, however, is an adverse effect on my 16-petal lotus flower. Had I been more restrained in my judgment and kept quiet about the matter in thought and word until I had reliable grounds to form a judgment, things would have turned out quite differently. Such tact, precision, and delicacy in forming and expressing judgments must gradually become our signature as esoteric students. At the same time, our sensitivity to impressions and experiences will increase. We should let these pass silently through us to create as many reference points as possible when it comes to forming a judgment. If we proceed cautiously in this way, then blue-red and rose-red nuances arise in the lotus petals. If we do not, then dark red and orange nuances appear. The 12-petaled lotus flower, near the heart, is formed in a way similar to the 16-petaled one. Footnote. People familiar with the subject matter will recognize in the requirements for the development of the 16-petaled lotus flower the instructions Buddha gave his disciples for the path. However, the point here is not to teach Buddhism, but to describe conditions for development that grow out of spiritual science itself. That they agree with certain teachings of Buddha does not make them any less true in themselves. End of footnote. Half of its petals were also already present and active in a past evolutionary stage of humanity. Thus, we do not have to develop those 6 petals. They appear on their own and begin to rotate when we start working on the other 6 petals. To promote their development, we must again deliberately orient certain soul activities in a particular direction. Paragraph 10. We have to realize that the perceptions provided by the various spiritual or soul senses differ in character. The 12-petaled lotus flower conveys a different perception from the 16-petaled one. The 16-petaled flower perceives forms, that is, it perceives as a form both another soul's way of thinking and the laws according to which a natural phenomenon unfolds. Such forms are not rigid and unmoving, but mobile and filled with life. A seer who has developed this sense organ can describe, for every way of thinking and natural law, the particular shape in which the thinking or law expresses itself. For example, a vengeful thought has an arrow-like and jagged shape, while a kind thought often has the form of a flower beginning to blossom, and so on. Thoughts that are firm and meaningful are symmetrical and regular. Concepts that are unclear have wavy, almost frizzy outlines. Quite different perceptions come to light through the 12-petaled lotus flower. These may be roughly characterized in terms of warmth and coldness of soul. Seers endowed with this sense organ feel soul warmth or coldness streaming from the figures perceived by the 16-petaled lotus flower. This means that a seer who has developed the 16-petaled lotus flower, but not the 12-petaled one, clairvoyantly perceives a kind thought only in terms of its figures described above. If, on the other hand, both organs are developed, then the seer also perceives something that can be described only as soul warmth streaming from the thought. In esoteric schooling, one sense organ is never developed apart from the others. The sense organs are always developed together. The above example, therefore, was given only hypothetically for the sake of clarity. Developing the 12-petaled lotus flower gives us profound insight into the processes of nature. Everything growing and maturing radiates soul warmth, while everything undergoing death, destruction, and decay has the quality of soul coldness. Paragraph 11. The 12-petaled lotus flower is formed in the following way. First, we pay attention to directing the sequence of our thoughts. This is the so-called, quote, practice of the control of thoughts, close quote. Just as thinking true and meaningful thoughts develops the 16-petal lotus flower, so inwardly controlling our thinking processes develops the 12-petal flower. Thoughts that flit about like will-o'-the-wisps and follow each other by chance, rather than in a logical, meaningful way, distort and damage the form of this flower. The more logically our thoughts follow one another, and the more we avoid all illogical thinking, the more perfectly this organ develops its proper form. Therefore, whenever we hear an illogical thought, we should immediately allow the correct thought to pass through our mind. But if we find ourselves in what seems an illogical environment, we should not for that reason unlovingly withdraw in order to further our development. By the same token, we should not feel the immediate urge to correct any illogicality we witness around us. Rather, we should inwardly and very quietly give the thoughts rushing at us from the outside a logical and meaningful direction. We should always strive to maintain this logical direction in our own thinking. Second, we must bring an equally logical consistency into our actions. This is the practice of the control of actions. Any instability and disharmony in our actions injures the development of the 12-petaled lotus flower. Therefore, each of our actions should follow logically from whatever action came before. If we act today out of different principles than we did yesterday, we shall never develop the lotus flower in question. Third, we must cultivate perseverance. As long as we consider a goal we have set ourselves to be right and worthy, we should never let any outside influence deter us from striving to reach it. We should consider obstacles as challenges to be overcome, not as reasons for giving up. Fourth, we must develop forbearance or tolerance toward other people, other beings, and events. We must suppress all unnecessary criticism of imperfection, evil, and wickedness, and seek rather to understand everything that comes to meet us. Just as the sun does not withdraw its light from wickedness and evil, so we too should not withdraw our understanding and sympathy from anyone. When we meet adversity, we should not indulge in negative judgments, but accept the inevitable and try as best we can to turn it to the good. Similarly, instead of considering the opinions of others only from our own standpoint, we should try to put ourselves into their position. Fifth, we must develop openness and impartiality toward all the phenomena of life. This is sometimes called faith or trust. We must learn to approach every person, every being, with trust. Such trust or confidence must inspire all our actions. We should never say in reply to something said to us, quote, "I don't believe that because it contradicts the opinion I have already formed," close quote. Rather, when faced with something new, we must always be willing to test our opinions and views and revise them if necessary. We must always remain receptive to whatever approaches us. We should trust in the effectiveness of whatever we undertake. All doubt and timidity should be banished from our being. If we have a goal, we must have faith in the power of our goal. Even 100 failures should not be able to take this faith from us. This is the, quote, "faith that can move mountains," close quote. Sixth, we must achieve a certain balance in life, or serenity. As esoteric students, we should strive to maintain a mood of inner harmony, whether joy or sorrow comes to meet us. We should lose the habit of swinging between being up one minute and down the next. Instead, we should be as prepared to deal with misfortune and danger as with joy and good fortune. Paragraph 12. The reader, unfamiliar with spiritual scientific literature, will recognize in the practice of these six qualities the so-called six attributes that a person seeking initiation has to develop. They are mentioned now because of their relationship to the development of the sense organ of the soul called the 12-petaled lotus flower. Esoteric training may also provide special instructions for bringing this lotus flower to maturity. But here, again, the fashioning of a regular form for the sense organ depends upon the development of the qualities or attributes already described. If we ignore the cultivation of these qualities, then this organ will be distorted into a caricature of itself. A certain faculty of seeing may be developed in the process, but as a result of distortion, any of the six attributes may be transformed and become bad rather than good. We may become intolerant, fearful, and negative toward our surroundings. For example, we may become sensitive to other people's soul mood and mentality, and for this reason avoid or dislike them. This may even go so far that coldness floods our soul whenever we hear opinions contrary to our own, with the result that we cannot listen to them or respond belligerently. Paragraph 13. Were we to add to the practices that have been suggested so far certain other rules which a student can receive only orally from a teacher, then we would be able to accelerate the development of this lotus flower. Nevertheless, the directions already given here definitely lead to true esoteric training. Organizing one's life along these lines is also beneficial for those who cannot or do not wish to undergo esoteric training. These practices will, in any case, work upon one's soul organism, even if only slowly. For the esoteric student, however, the observation of these fundamental principles is essential. To attempt an occult training without following these guidelines would be to enter the higher worlds with defective mental eyes. Instead of cognizing the truth, one would be subject only to deceptions and illusions. We might become clairvoyant to a certain extent, but essentially we would be susceptible to an even greater blindness than before. Before beginning esoteric practice, we at least stood firmly in the sense world and had a certain foothold in it. Now, perhaps we can see behind it, but because we have not gained a firm hold in a higher world, we begin to lose our way there. And this may lead us to lose our ability to distinguish truth and error, and to lose all sense of direction in life. This is why patience is so necessary in these matters. We must always bear in mind that the instructions of spiritual science may lead us no further than our complete willingness to develop the lotus flowers in a harmonious manner. If these flowers are brought to maturity before they have quietly developed their appropriate forms, then only a distorted travesty of the true form of the flower develops. For while the specific exercises given by spiritual science produce the maturation of the flowers, their form is given by the way of living that has been described. Paragraph 14. The development of the 10-petaled lotus flower near the solar plexus requires cultivating soul care of a particularly subtle and delicate kind. Here it is a matter of learning to consciously control and master the sense impressions themselves. This is especially important in the early stages of clairvoyant seeing. Only by learning to control and master sense impressions can we avoid a source of countless illusions and arbitrary spiritual fantasies. As a rule, we do not realize what controls the occurrence of ideas and memories, and how they are called forth. Consider the following. We are riding in a train, wrapped up in our own thoughts, when, suddenly, our thinking takes a completely new turn. We remember something that happened many years ago. We weave this into our present thoughts. What we do not notice is that our eyes, looking through the window, fell upon a person resembling someone involved in the event we recalled. But we are not conscious of what we saw. We are aware only of the effect it has produced in us. Therefore, we think that our memory of the event occurred, quote, of its own accord, close quote. How much in life comes about in this way? Many things we have seen or read play into our lives without our being conscious of the connections. For example, we may dislike a certain color and not know why. We have forgotten that a teacher who tormented us years ago used to wear a coat of that color. Countless illusions are based on such connections. Many things are imprinted into our soul without, at the same time, being assimilated into our consciousness. For example, we read in the newspaper that a famous person died, and we believe, we insist, that we had a premonition of this death the day before, even though we saw and heard nothing that could have given rise to the thought. And it is true that, as if spontaneously, the thought that this famous person would die arose in us the day before. A single fact alone escaped our notice. When we visited a friend a few hours before this thought arose, a newspaper lay on the table. We did not read it, but unconsciously our eyes registered the headlines. These announced the critical condition of the celebrity in question. We were unaware of this impression. The effect is produced, however. The effect it produced, however, was our, in quotes, premonition. In the light of these examples, it is clear that such unconscious relationships present a great source of illusion and fantasy. The development of the 10-petaled lotus flower requires that we block off this source. This lotus flower allows us to perceive deeply hidden soul qualities. But we can rely on the truth of these perceptions only if we are completely free of such deceptions. To achieve this, we must make ourselves masters of what affects us from the outer world. We must reach the point where we actually do not receive any impressions that we do not want. Only a strong inner life can develop this capacity. It must actually enter our will and become second nature there, that we allow only those things to work upon us that we have intentionally focused upon. In other words, we must be completely unavailable to those impressions to which we have not turned our attention. We must see only what we want or will to see. What we do not turn our attention to, in fact, must not exist for us. The more lively and energetic our inner soul work becomes, the more we will achieve this. Students of esoteric training must avoid all mindless gazing and listening. Only those things that we deliberately focus our eyes and ears upon must exist for us. We must make it a practice not to hear what we do not want to hear, no matter what turmoil is going on around us. Our eyes must become unreceptive to anything we do not choose to focus on. We must be surrounded as if by a kind of soul armor against all unconscious impressions. To this end, we turn our care and attention, above all, to our thought life. For example, we must choose a particular thought and then try to think through this thought, only thinking such thoughts as we can integrate into it in full consciousness and complete freedom. If any random thoughts arise, we must reject them. And if we link one thought with another, we consider carefully how this second thought arose. But this is only the beginning. For instance, if we feel a particular antipathy for something, we combat this feeling and try to develop a conscious relationship to the thing in question. As a result of these kinds of exercises, fewer and fewer unconscious elements interfere with our soul life. Strict self-discipline of this kind is the only way to develop the true form of the ten-petaled lotus flower. If we wish to pursue this path to higher knowledge and become true esoteric students, our soul life must become a life lived in a state of attention. We must know how to really keep away all that we do not want to pay attention to, or ought not to pay attention to. If we combine such self-discipline with a practice of meditation consonant with the indications given by spiritual science, the lotus flower, located in the solar plexus, matures properly. What had only shape and warmth for the spiritual sense organs we have previously described will now contain spiritual light and color. This will reveal to us the gifts and abilities of other souls, as well as the forces and hidden qualities in nature. The color aura of living beings will become visible to us, and everything around us will manifest its soul-like qualities. It must be admitted that great care and attention to detail are necessary in working on this soul organ, because unconscious memories are particularly active here. If this were not so, many people would possess the sense organ in question, since it appears almost immediately upon our ability to control our sense impressions so completely that they are fully under the command of the attention. It is, after all, only the power of the physical senses that keeps this inner soul sense muted, dull, and ineffective. Paragraph 15. The development of the six-petaled lotus flower, located in the center of the body, is more difficult still. Its formation requires that we strive for the complete mastery of our whole being through becoming conscious of ourself in such a way that within this consciousness, body, soul, and spirit are in perfect harmony. Physical activity, the inclinations and passions of the soul, and the thoughts and ideas of the spirit must be brought into perfect accord with each other. We should purify and ennoble the body to such an extent that our physical organs no longer compel us to do anything that is not in the service of our soul and spirit. The body should not urge upon our soul desires and passions that contradict pure and noble thinking. Nor should the spirit rule the soul with compulsory duties and laws like a slave driver. Rather, the soul should follow these obligations and laws of its own free inclination. As students, we should not think of duties as something imposed upon us that we grudgingly perform. We should perform them because we love them. This means that the soul must become free, poised in perfect balance between the senses and the spirit. We must reach the point in our development where we can surrender to our sense nature, because it has been so purified that it no longer has the power to drag us down. We should no longer need to restrain our passions, because these follow the right course on their own. Indeed, as long as we still need to mortify ourselves, we cannot advance beyond a certain level of esoteric training. Virtues that we have to force upon ourselves are without value. As long as we still have cravings, these will interfere with our training, even when we try not to give in to them. It makes no difference whether the desires arise from the body or the soul. For example, if we abstain from a certain stimulant in order to purify ourselves, by denying ourselves the pleasure it affords, this will help us only if the body does not suffer any discomforts in the process. For the discomfort we experience only indicates that the body still craves the stimulant, and therefore abstention is useless. In such cases, we may have to renounce our aspirations for the time being and wait for more favorable physical conditions, perhaps in a later life. In certain situations, a sensible renunciation is a much greater accomplishment than the continued striving for something that cannot be achieved under existing conditions. Such sensible renunciation advances our development more than the opposite course of persisting despite indications to the contrary. Paragraph 16. The development of the six-petaled lotus flower brings us into relation with beings of the higher worlds, but only with those whose existence is also revealed in the soul world. In esoteric training, the development of this lotus flower is recommended only after we have advanced to the point where we can lift our spirit into a still higher world. Entry into the actual spirit world must always go along with the development of the lotus flowers. Otherwise, confusion and uncertainty follow. We would learn to see, but we would lack the faculty of rightly evaluating what we saw. Of course, the requirements for the development of the six-petaled lotus flower are in themselves already a kind of guarantee against confusion and instability. For once we have achieved a perfect balance between the senses, body, the passions, soul, and ideas, spirit, we are no longer easily confused. Still, having something more than this assurance is needed when, having developed the six-petaled lotus flower, we begin to perceive living and autonomous beings that belong to a world very different from the world of the physical senses. The development of the lotus flowers is not enough to give us confidence and certainty in these worlds. We have to have still higher organs at our disposal. We shall now discuss the development of these higher organs before continuing the discussion of the other lotus flowers and the further organization of the, in quotes, soul body. Footnote: obviously the term soul body, in its literal meaning, presents a paradox, as does many another term of spiritual science. Nevertheless, we use this expression because the clairvoyant perception in question is experienced spiritually in the same way as the body is in the physical realm. End of footnote. Paragraph 17. The development of the soul body just mentioned enables us to perceive supersensible phenomena. But if we are to find our way about in this world, we cannot remain at this stage of development. Simply achieving mobility of the lotus flowers is not enough. We must be able to regulate and control by our own will and in full consciousness the movements of our spiritual organs. Otherwise, we become a plaything of outer forces and powers. To avoid this, we must be able to hear what is called the, in quotes, inner word. And for this, we need to develop not only the soul body, but also the ether body. The ether body is the subtle body that is seen by clairvoyance as a kind of double of the physical body. One might say it is an intermediate stage between the physical body and the soul body. Footnote C, also its description in my book titled Theosophy. End of footnote. If we have the gift of clairvoyant faculties, we can consciously think away the physical body of a person standing before us. This is basically the same as an exercise in attention, except that it occurs on a higher level. Just as we can turn our attention away from things around us, with the result that they no longer exist for us, so those who are clairvoyant can completely erase the physical body from their perception. Consequently, the physical body becomes totally transparent. When clairvoyants erase the physical body of someone standing before them, what still remains before their soul eyes are the so-called ether body and the soul body, which is larger than the physical and ether bodies and permeates both. The ether body has about the same size and shape as the physical body, and so occupies approximately the same space as the physical body. It is an extremely delicate and finely organized structure. Footnote: I have to ask physicists not to be put off by the term ether body. The word ether is intended merely to express the delicacy of the formation under consideration. What is said here need not be connected in any way with the ether in certain hypotheses in physics. End of footnote. Its basic color is one not found among the seven colors of the rainbow. As we become able to observe the ether body, we learn to see a color that actually does not exist for sensory observation. It is best compared to the color of young peach blossoms. Of course, to study the ether body alone, we have to remove the soul body from our perception through an exercise of attentiveness similar to the one mentioned above. If this is not done, the appearance of the ether body will be changed by the soul body, which permeates it completely. Paragraph 18. The tiny particles of the human ether body are in constant movement. Countless currents stream through it in all directions. These currents maintain and regulate life. Hence, every living body has an ether body. Plants and animals have one. And an attentive observer may even see traces of the ether body in minerals. Without esoteric training, these currents and movements are completely independent of our will and consciousness. They are like the activities of the heart or the stomach, which are likewise independent of our will. As long, then, as we do not take our development into our own hands and begin to work on developing supersensible faculties, the ether body maintains its complete independence from us. Further esoteric development, therefore, consists precisely in adding to those movements of the ether body, which are independent of our consciousness, currents and movements that we ourselves have consciously produced. Paragraph 19. By the time esoteric training has reached the stage when the lotus flowers begin to rotate or move, we have already done much of the preparatory work needed to produce certain specific currents and movements in the ether body. The goal of our development is now to form a kind of central point near the physical heart, from which currents and movements spread in manifold spiritual colors and shapes. In reality, of course, this center is not really a point, but rather a quite complex formation, a marvelous organ, shining and shimmering spiritually, in a great variety of colors, and revealing quickly changing shapes of great regularity. Further forms and streams of color radiate out from this central organ to the other parts of the body, and even beyond it, permeating and illuminating the entire soul body. The most important currents, however, flow to the lotus flowers, permeating each petal and regulating their rotation. The currents then flow out from the tips of the petals and disappear into the surrounding space. The more developed a person is, the greater the circumference formed by these spreading currents. Paragraph 20. The 12-petaled lotus flower is closely related to the central point described above. All the currents flow directly into and through this point. Thence, on the one side, some currents continue up to the 16 and the 2-petaled lotus flowers, while on the other, lower side, they flow down to the 8, 6, and 4-petaled flowers. This arrangement accounts for the fact that in esoteric training, especially careful attention is paid to the development of the 12-petaled lotus flower. If any mistake is made here, the development of the whole system is thrown into disorder. We can see, therefore, how very delicate and intimate a matter esoteric training is, and with what precision we must proceed if everything is to develop in the right way. That is why only those who have themselves experienced what they teach can give instructions for the development of supersensible faculties. For only on this basis are they in a position to know whether their instructions are producing the right results. Paragraph 21. When we follow the instructions given here, we acquire currents and movements in our ether body which are in harmony with the laws and evolution of the world to which we belong. For this reason, instructions in esoteric training always mirror the great laws of world evolution. These instructions consist in the meditation and concentration exercises mentioned in this book, as well as other similar exercises. Applied properly, these exercises produce the effects that have been described. Students of the Spirit should set aside certain times when they completely permeate their souls with the content of such exercises, thereby becoming, as it were, inwardly filled with them. We begin with simple exercises, above all those designed to deepen and spiritualize our powers of reasoning and understanding. Such exercises render our thinking free and independent of all sense impressions and experiences. We concentrate our thinking in one point, so to speak, over which we then have complete control. In the process, a temporary center is created for the currents of the ether body. In other words, initially the central point is not located near the heart, but in the head. Seers can perceive it there as the starting point of the above-mentioned etheric movements. Only an esoteric training that begins by creating this temporary center in the head can be completely successful. If we were to develop the center near the heart immediately, we would certainly still gain a glimpse into the higher worlds at the early stages of clairvoyance. But we would have no true insight into the connection between these higher worlds and the material world of the senses. It is absolutely essential, however, that human beings at the present stage of world evolution understand this connection. As seers, we must not become dreamers. We must always keep both feet firmly on the ground. Paragraph 22. Once the temporary center in the head has been properly stabilized, further practice of the concentration exercises transfers it downward into the vicinity of the larynx. The movements and currents of the ether body then spread out from there, illuminating the soul space around us. Paragraph 23. Further practice of these exercises will enable us to determine the position of the ether body for ourselves. Before entering esoteric training, the position of the ether body depended upon forces coming from outside and from the physical body. But as we advance successfully in our development, we become able to turn the ether body in all directions, using the currents that flow roughly parallel to the hands, and whose center lies in the two-petaled lotus flower near the eyes. This is possible because the currents flowing from the larynx form rounded shapes, some of which flow toward the two-petaled lotus flower, and thence continue on as wave-like currents along the hands. These currents then ramify and branch out in the most delicate way to form a kind of net. This becomes a sort of membranous network at the boundary of the ether body. Before we began practicing, the ether body was not enclosed. The currents of life flowed in and out from the universal ocean of life directly and unhindered. Now, however, all influences from the outside have to pass through this thin web or skin. As a result, we become sensitive to these outer currents and begin to perceive them. The time has now come to give this complex system of currents and movements a center near the heart. This is done by continuing the concentration and meditation exercises. At the same time, this moment marks the stage of our development at which we receive the gift of the, quote, inner word, close quote. Henceforth, all things have a new sense and meaning for us. They become, as it were, spiritually audible to us in their inmost essence. They speak to us of their true nature. What happens is that the currents described above put us in touch with the inner life of the cosmos to which we belong. We begin to participate in the life around us and let this life reverberate in the movements of our lotus flowers. Paragraph 24. With this we enter the world of the Spirit. We become able to understand the words of the great teachers of humanity in a new way. The Buddha's sermons or the Gospels, for example, work upon us in a completely new way. They stream through us, permeating us with a bliss we never imagined before. For the melody of their words harmonizes with the movements and rhythms we have formed within ourselves. Now we can know directly that beings such as the Buddha or the writings of the Gospels, writers of the Gospels, do not voice their own revelations, but only what flows into them from the innermost essence of things. Here I may point out something that can be understood only in light of what we have learned about the ether body. Many educated people today find the repetitions in the Buddha's discourses difficult to understand. But once we embark upon the esoteric path, we learn to enjoy dwelling on these repetitions with our inner senses. For these repetitions correspond to certain rhythmical movements in the ether body. And when we surrender to the repetitions in perfect inner peace, our inner movements blend harmoniously with them. When we listen to the word melodies of the Buddha's teaching, our life becomes infused with the secrets of the universe. For the movements of Buddha's word melodies mirror cosmic rhythms that also consist of repetitions and regular returns to earlier rhythms. Paragraph 25. Spiritual science speaks of four faculties that must be acquired on the so-called preparatory path, or path of probation, before one can advance to higher knowledge. The first is the ability to distinguish in our thinking between truth and appearance, between what is true and what is simply opinion. The second is the ability to value truth and reality rightly in relation to appearances. The third consists in the application of the six qualities mentioned in the preceding chapter: control of thoughts, control of actions, perseverance, tolerance, faith, and equanimity. The fourth is the love of inner freedom. Paragraph 26. Mere intellectual understanding of what is contained in these faculties is quite useless. They must be integrated in the soul and establish inner habits there. Take, for example, the first faculty of distinguishing between truth and appearance. Here we must train ourselves so that it becomes second nature to discriminate between what is not essential and what is meaningful in everything we encounter. Such training requires us to practice this discrimination with regard to everything we observe in the outer world. We must seek to do this at all times and with complete inner calm and patience. Eventually, our eyes will come to turn as easily to what is real and true as they turned before to what was not essential. And the truth of Goethe's words that, quote, "everything transient is but a symbol," close quote, will become a natural conviction in our souls. The same process also applies, of course, to the development of the other three faculties mentioned above. Paragraph 27. Under the influence of these faculties, now become inner soul habits, the delicate human ether body becomes transformed. The practice of the first, quote, "distinguishing between truth and appearance," close quote, forms the center for the lotus flower in the head, and at the same time prepares the center near the larynx. The actual formation of these centers, however, depends upon carrying out the concentration exercises mentioned above. The concentration exercises develop and form the centers, while the practice of the four inner habits of soul brings them to maturity. Once the center near the larynx is prepared, the second faculty, that of, quote, "rightly valuing the true over inessential appearance," close quote, enables us to freely control, cover, and mark the boundaries of the ether body with the web or network. At this point, if we value the truth above all things and make this second nature, we gradually begin to see spiritual facts. But we should never make the mistake of thinking that a rational, intellectual evaluation of what is significant should determine our actions. Even the smallest acts and the least chores have a significance in the great household of the cosmos. It is a matter of becoming conscious of this significance, of not undervaluing the everyday affairs of life, and of learning to value them rightly. We have already discussed the six virtues: control of thoughts and actions, perseverance, patience, faith, and equanimity, that combine to form the third faculty. These virtues are connected with the development of the 12-petaled lotus flower near the heart. It is to this region, as we indicated above, that we must guide the ether body's current of life. The fourth faculty, that of, quote, desiring liberation, close quote, love of inner freedom, serves to bring the ether organ near the heart to maturity. Once this love of freedom has become a soul habit, we ourselves become free of all that is connected only with capacities of an individual personal nature. We cease to look at things from our own separate, particular point of view. The boundaries set by the narrow self, which chain us to this perspective, vanish, and the mysteries of the spiritual world may enter our inner life. This is the sought-for liberation. The fetters of the narrow self force us to view beings and things in a personal way. To attain higher knowledge, we must become free of these fetters of a personal and limited way of looking at things. Paragraph 28. One can see from all this that the instructions drawn from spiritual science work decisively into the innermost depths of human nature. The directions regarding the four faculties are instructions of this kind. They are to be found in one form or another in all the philosophies that acknowledge the existence of a spiritual world. The founders of such philosophies did not bequeath these instructions to humanity on the basis of some vague feeling. They did so because they were great initiates. They formed their moral precepts on the basis of their cognition. They knew that these precepts would affect humanity's finer and nobler nature, and they wanted their disciples gradually to train this nature. To live by such world views and philosophies means to work on perfecting ourselves spiritually. Only when we do this do we serve the cosmos as a whole. To perfect oneself in this way is by no means selfish. As long as we are imperfect human beings, we are also imperfect servants of humanity and the world. The more perfected we are, the better we can serve the whole. The saying, quote, if a rose is beautiful, it makes the garden beautiful, close quote, is also true of human beings. Paragraph 29. The founders of the greatest philosophies are therefore great initiates. Their teachings flow into human souls, and by this means the whole world advances with humanity. Indeed, they worked consciously for the progress of human evolution. Thus, we can understand the content of their teachings only when we bear in mind that it is drawn from knowledge of the inmost depths of human nature. The initiates were great Gnostics, seekers after knowledge. They knew, and they shaped humanity's ideals out of their knowledge. We, too, can approach these great leaders of humanity if in our own development we seek to raise ourselves to their heights. Paragraph 30. After the ether body begins to develop in the way described above, a whole new life opens up before us. To find our way in this new life, we need the enlightenment that esoteric training at the appropriate moment can provide. For example, at a certain point, the 16-petaled lotus flower enables us to see spiritually the beings and forms of a higher world. But now we must learn to distinguish among the forms. They differ depending on whether they are caused by an object or a being. At first, we should pay attention to how our own thoughts and feelings can influence these forms, strongly or only slightly, or perhaps not at all. Some forms will change immediately if, when we first see them, we think, quote, "That is beautiful," close quote, and then in the course of contemplation change that to, quote, "That is useful," close quote. These forms that characteristically change with our every thought or feeling are those produced by minerals or human-made objects. Forms arising from plants change less easily in response to our thoughts and feelings, and those of animals even less so. These latter forms are full of life and movement. This mobility is due partly to the influence of our thoughts and feelings, and partly to causes over which we have no control. In the world of forms, however, there are some that remain, initially at least, outside human influence. By inner study, we can determine to our satisfaction that such forms may be ascribed neither to minerals or artificial objects, nor to plants or animals. Further clarity is gained when we next observe the forms that we know result from people's emotions, instincts, passions, and so on. We find that our own thoughts and feelings still have an influence on these, although it is relatively slight. Thus, after eliminating all these, there still remain some forms upon which we have only a negligible effect, if any. Indeed, at the beginning of our esoteric practice, the forms upon which we can have hardly any influence at all constitute the greater part of what we can see. In fact, to understand the nature of this group, we must observe ourselves. Then we find out which forms we ourselves are causing. We discover that it is what we ourselves do, want, and so on, that is expressed in these forms. They manifest our instincts, desires, and intentions. Indeed, our whole character is expressed by this particular world. In other words, we find that our conscious thoughts and feelings can influence all the forms in this higher world that are not produced by us. But once the forms produced by our being come into existence, we cannot influence them. To the eye of higher vision, a human being's inner life displays itself in outer figures, just like other things and beings. The inner world of instincts, desires, and ideas becomes, for higher cognition, a part of the outer world. Just as, when surrounded by mirrors in the physical world, we can see our bodily form from all sides, so in a higher world, we can see a mirror image of our soul being. Paragraph 31. At this stage of esoteric development, we reach the point where we can overcome the illusion deriving from the narrowness of the personal self. Where, before, we regarded only what worked upon our senses as the outer world, now we can regard what lives inwardly, in our personality, also as an outer world. In this way, we gradually learn from experience to deal with ourselves in the same way as we deal with the beings in the world around us. Paragraph 32. If we were to see the spiritual worlds before we were sufficiently prepared for their nature, the picture of our own soul, as described above, would arise before us as a riddle. For in the spiritual world we are faced with the figures and forms of our instincts and passions in animal, or more rarely, human shape. Though the forms of these animals in the spiritual world are never quite the same as they are in the physical world, there is nevertheless a similarity between them. The unpracticed observer would probably find them identical. Therefore, as we enter the higher world, we must acquire entirely new ways of evaluating what we see. Furthermore, not only do things that belong to our inner life appear outwardly around us, but they also appear as mirror images of what they really are. Numbers, for instance, must be read in reverse. 265 really means 562. Similarly, we see spheres as though we were at their center, and then we must translate, as it were, this interior view. Soul qualities, too, appear in mirror images. For example, a desire for something external will manifest as a form moving toward the desiring person. And the passions, which are seated in our lower nature, can take on the shapes of animals or animal-like beings hurling themselves upon us. In fact, of course, these passions are directed at the outside world. It is in the outer world that they seek the object that will satisfy them. In the mirror image, however, this seeking for satisfaction outside appears as an assault on the person harboring the passions. Paragraph 33. Esoteric students who, before ascending to higher vision, have come to know their own character traits by calm, objective self-observation, will find the strength and courage to act appropriately when they see the externalized mirror image of their inner being. But those who have not gained sufficient knowledge of themselves by such self-examination will not recognize themselves in their mirror image, and will mistake that image for a different alien reality. Or the sight may frighten them, and because they cannot bear it, they may convince themselves that the whole thing is a fantastic figment without consequence. Clearly, as both cases demonstrate, reaching this stage of inner development prematurely and without proper preparation can fatally impede one's further training. Paragraph 34. In order to proceed further, it is essential to pass through the experience of spiritually seeing our own soul. For the soul and spirit beings we are best placed to understand are those which live within ourselves. If we have worked diligently in the physical world to acquire knowledge of our own personality, and we then immediately encounter its image in the higher world, we can compare the two. We can relate the higher phenomenon to one we already know, and thus set forth from solid ground. Otherwise, no matter how many other spiritual beings approach us, we would be unable to gain any understanding of their natures and special characters. Indeed, we would soon feel the ground giving way beneath our feet. It cannot be emphasized often enough that the sure path to higher worlds leads to careful self-knowledge and the self-assessment of our own nature. Paragraph 35. What we first encounter on the road to the higher worlds are thus spiritual images. This is because the reality to which these images corresponds lies within ourselves. Consequently, as students of the occult, we must be mature enough not to expect solid realities at this stage, and to consider images as appropriate to our present level of contemplation. But within this world of images, we can discover something new. Although our lower self comes before us only as a mirror image, our higher self appears in the middle of it, in its true reality. Out of the image of our lower personality, the true form of the spiritual capital I becomes visible. From this spiritual I, the threads are then spun out to other higher spiritual realities. Paragraph 36. This is the moment to use the two-petaled lotus flower in the region of the eyes. Once this lotus flower begins to move, we are in a position to establish a connection between our higher I and higher spiritual beings. This is because the currents or streams emanating from this lotus flower move toward higher realities in such a way that we can be fully conscious of their movements. Indeed, just as light makes physical objects visible to our eyes, so these streams make the spiritual beings of the higher worlds visible to us. Paragraph 37. It is by means of meditative absorption in the ideas of spiritual science, which contain fundamental truths that students of the inner path learn to set in motion and direct the currents that stream from the lotus flower between the eyes. Paragraph 38. At this point in our development, the value of sound judgment and a training in clarity and logical thought become especially evident. We need only bear in mind that the higher self, which until now has lain dormant within us, seed-like and unconscious, is here born into conscious existence. This birth is not just an image. It is a literal birth in an absolutely real sense, a birth into the spiritual world. And, if it is to be viable, the being that is born, the higher self, must enter this world with all its necessary organs and faculties. Just as nature must take care that infants are born with fully formed, healthy eyes and ears, so the laws of our own development must ensure that our higher self begins its conscious existence equipped with all the faculties it needs. The laws that are instrumental in the development of our higher spiritual organs are none other than the sound laws of reason and morality in the physical world. Just as babies mature in their mother's wombs, so the spiritual human being develops within the physical self. And just as the health of a baby depends on the normal functioning of nature's laws in the mother's womb, so the health of our spiritual humanity is likewise contingent on the laws of our ordinary understanding at work in our life on earth. No one can give birth to a healthy higher self who does not live and think in a healthy manner in the physical world. Living in harmony with nature and reason is the basis of all true spiritual development. Just as a baby, while still in its mother's womb, already lives according to the forces of nature that its sense organs will perceive only after it has been born, so in physical life, the human higher self already lives according to the laws of the spiritual world. And just as an unborn child, out of an obscure feeling or consciousness of life, makes use of the forces it needs, so we too can use the forces of the spiritual world before our higher self is born. Indeed, we must make use of these forces if our higher self is to enter the world as a fully developed being. It would be wrong, therefore, to think that we cannot accept the teachings of spiritual science until we can see for ourselves. For without immersing ourselves in such spiritual research, we cannot attain any higher knowledge at all. To refuse to do so would be like a baby's refusing to use the forces available to it through its mother's body, and wanting to wait until it could acquire them for itself. Just as the embryo dimly feels the rightness of what is offered, so we can have a sense for the truth of the teachings of spiritual science, even before we become clairvoyant. Relying upon the feeling for truth and clear, healthy, many-sided, critical thinking, we can gain an insight into the teachings of spiritual science, even though we do not yet see spiritual realities. First, we must study the fruits of mystical knowledge. This prepares us for our own spiritual perception. If we became able to see spiritually without such preparation, we would be like a child born with eyes and ears, but without a brain. The whole world of colors and sounds would be spread out before us, but we could form no connection with it. Paragraph 39. What was convincing and obvious to us before, because of our feeling for truth, our intuition, and our reason, becomes first-hand experience for us at the level of spiritual schooling or discipleship just described. We now have immediate knowledge of our higher self, and thereby we learn to recognize that this higher self is linked with spiritual beings of a still higher order and forms a unity with them. Moreover, we see that our lower self also originates in a higher world, and we are shown that our higher nature outlasts our lower nature. Consequently, we ourselves can now distinguish our transitory part from our permanent part, self. In other words, we come to understand by our own power of vision the doctrine of the embodiment or incarnation of the higher self in the lower self. It then becomes clear that we are part of a higher spiritual context, which determines our qualities and our destiny. We begin to understand the law of human life, namely karma. We realize that our lower self, which shapes our existence in the present, is only one of the many forms our higher being can assume. And in this way, we realize that it is possible to work on the lower self from the perspective of the higher self in order to become more and more perfect. From this moment on, we become able to discern great differences between human beings with respect to their degree of perfection. We become aware that there are people more advanced than we are, who have reached levels that still lie ahead of us. It becomes clear, too, that their teachings and actions derive from inspirations from the higher worlds. We recognize that this is so from our own first glimpses of those worlds. Thus the expression, quote, great initiates of humanity, close quote, now begins to take on concrete meaning for us. Paragraph 40. The gifts that the student of the inner path receives by virtue of achieving this stage of development are these: insight into the higher self and into the doctrine of the embodiment or incarnation of this higher self in a lower self. Insight into the law by which life in the physical world is regulated according to spiritual relationships, the law of karma. And finally, insight into the existence of the great initiates. Paragraph 41. Therefore, it is said of students who have reached this stage that they lose all doubt. Before, their faith was built on reason and healthy thinking, but now this faith can be replaced by complete knowledge and insight that nothing can shatter. Paragraph 42. Religious ceremonies, sacraments, and rites give us outwardly visible images of higher spiritual processes. Only a person who has not yet fully understood the depths of the great religions can fail to see that this is so. Once we can look into spiritual reality, we can also understand the great significance of those outwardly visible actions. Then religious services themselves become an image of our relationship to the higher spiritual world. Paragraph 43. By reaching this stage of inner development, students of the spirit actually become new beings. They can now mature gradually to the point where, by means of the currents of the ether body, they are able to control a still higher element, the element of life, and thereby achieve a great degree of freedom from the physical body. The end of chapter 6.